6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live
and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan. Have a fascinating hour ahead of us. We'll be speaking with Greg Paul. He's the author of Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. So as mentioned, Greg Paul is joining us for the hour. And his book, Power from the People, is all about ways that you can make a difference locally in terms of energy-related projects that have a great way to show potential to take care of the concerns that we have now about decreasing options in terms of traditional energy sources, but also just a way to empower local communities to take some measure of control over their own destinies. And pleased to say that we, Greg, let me start by just welcoming you to A Public Affair.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Greg, as I mentioned to you earlier, we also have a guest who's got kind of a time-limited chance to join us, and he's someone that you interviewed for the book in a Dane County context. John Welch is on the phone, kind enough to join us from his travels on the road today. And John is the recycling manager for Dane County, also has a national role as someone who's involved with the Solid Waste Association of North America, and there's a local project that we hope that John can tell us about. Maybe this is a way to kick off that theme of how acting locally is one of the best ways that we can address this energy crisis. John, are you there?
Yes, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so glad to have you here. So, John, could you describe a project that is rather distinctive to Dane County in terms of using landfill gas? And also, sort of an extension off of that, compressed natural gas. Essentially, is it right? Essentially, what you're talking about are different ways of converting solid waste and garbage to use as fuel?
Exactly, yeah. So just trying to take what is naturally occurring in the landfill. As the garbage is breaking down, you're producing methane gas. And so we've been using that beneficially for well over 15 years now. We use that as actually a fuel and special engines and generators to produce renewable electricity. We do over 4,000 homes worth of electricity and have for, like I said, over 15 years. But we also wanted to look at some of the, better uses for it. What else could we be using this gas for? And that's kind of how we fell into the project we're doing now. We're actually taking a small portion of our landfill gas, cleaning it up to near pipeline natural gas grade quality, and then compressing it so that it's now compressed natural gas, which we're using as fuel in a number of our county fleet vehicles.
Now, in the book, you describe that some of the carbon dioxide off gas that's removed from the system goes right back into the gas line, used up by the electric generators. Essentially, I think the point you're making there is that co-locating a smaller scale project like this with a larger system is something that makes a lot of sense. Could you elaborate on that point?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, we have the large electric generator engines already in place. And just like you said, co-locating a smaller system like this makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons. We're able to take the off gases there, cycle those back through, and since it is a smaller scale system, blending those gases back in with the rest of our landfill gas, when electric generating engines don't even notice the difference, it allows us to still destruct those gases in an environmentally conscious manner.
Now, this can be used in conjunction both with landfills, but also municipal wastewater reclamation. Is that right?
Yeah, it could be used with any of the biogas, and kind of the three big players there would be either a landfill operation, wastewater treatment plant, as you mentioned, or more and more you're starting to see this with even egg digesters, manure digesters, and those types of systems.
Now go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, and Greg will probably touch on this, the dynamics are changing as far as the end uses for these things, and with the electric utility rates and things happening in that market, we're starting to see a shift with biogas away from electric production and more looking at other options and starting to look at CNG, compressed natural gas, as the end use for these gas.
Now, you have an involvement as well, as I mentioned at the outset, with the Solid Waste Association of North America. Are you seeing inquiries? Are you getting folks that are wanting to find out some of the things that are happening here in Dane County and wanting to replicate them on a national level?
Yeah, absolutely. This project of ours, it actually won the EPA Project of the Year Award. So they garnered quite a bit of interest throughout the nation. We've had several hundred people from virtually every state and several countries come and visit the project, people asking for it. More feedback, more information on it. CNG from landfill gas had been done on a handful of sites prior to this, but never before had it been done on such a small scale and been made economical. So we've seen a tremendous interest from people from all over the nation in this type of project.
All right, John, I know you have limited time today, so probably let you go in just a second, but I just want to give Greg Paul a chance, sorry to kind of back you into this conversation, but did you have anything that you wanted to add or ask of John?
I think John has covered it pretty well, although, as I recall, there were several other projects similar in size to what you folks have in Dane County, and I was just wondering if John had heard any more recent reports from some of those other potential sites.
Sure, yes. After, we were kind of, for better or worse, the guinea pig on this system, at least from this manufacturer. It worked out really well. We did a pilot scale system for a year. Dane County was really happy, and as a result of that, we ended up purchasing the equipment, doubling its capacity. As a side to all of that success that we saw with our initial pilot system, there have been a number of other systems that have gone in since then. One is at the Janesville Wastewater Treatment Plant in Wisconsin. Another one is down at a solid waste authority at one of the parishes in Louisiana. And then there are at least a couple other systems nationwide that are in the works or are being installed very shortly.
Hey, John Welch, thank you so much for taking time from your day and your travels to join us. And as I mentioned, we'll try to get you back on the air here when we can have you in studio to talk about this at greater length. But it's great to know that Dane County is taking the lead on such an innovative project. Thanks for coming.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, once again, for just those of you who are joining us in midstream here as we launch into our longer discussion with Greg Paul, this is Public Affair here on WRT. I'm your host, John Quinlan, and Greg Paul, again, is joining us on the phone from out in his home in Vermont. He is the author of Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. A notable subtitle is A Community Resilience Guide. Actually, in a foreword to the book, share for you briefly, Van Jones, who's well-known to many folks as a cutting-edge local activist, he says that this book rests on an optimistic image on a pessimistic premise. The sobering underlying thesis is that human civilization is already in big trouble, both ecologically and economically. Things are going to get much worse. But the hopeful underlying message is that we still have the capacity to pull good outcomes from even the most frightening scenarios. The paradox is this: only by recognizing how much worse things can get can we muster the energy and creativity to win a better future. 608-256-2001 is the number to join us throughout this call. Greg Paul, Van Jones, invoking that there's a darker reality or something that's kind of scary underlying all of this. Do you agree that perhaps, especially maybe in the wake of this week's elections and people maybe coming into power, that there are advocates for alternative energy, that perhaps there is still time to find solutions?
Well, certainly. There's no question that we face an enormous number of challenges, and I think the recent Hurricane Sandy in the New York, New Jersey, Long Island area certainly has added a rather large exclamation point to that issue. I think more and more people are beginning to get it and are beginning to understand just how vulnerable we can be in many ways when our infrastructure is damaged to the extent that it was in the hurricane and the storm surge. And I think the interrelationships of our infrastructure, I think, is becoming much clearer to a lot of people. That all you have to do is break a couple of weak links in the chain, and the whole thing starts to fall apart. And so, you know, we do face some really serious challenges, but I also like to look at this optimistically as an opportunity for, especially for local communities who have just gotten tired of waiting for somebody else to do something and are willing to roll up their sleeves and get right into it and try to come up with some meaningful local solutions of their own.
You know, in terms of lessons out of Hurricane Sandy, I think the mainstream press and folks like Mayor Bloomberg have pointed out one of the obvious things, that global climate change is real, and it's something that needs to be addressed. But you're touching also, I think, in your book on another reality, that maybe the solutions also involve acting locally, that the vulnerability that you're describing to some of our current energy system is the vastness of it, its interconnectivity. And of course, one of the big things, if you live in Staten Island or Rockaway or a lot of New Jersey homes, is utility companies are kind of slow to getting around to getting people back online and doing things. And you know, they're monopolies, and perhaps they don't have necessarily a lot of incentive or public interest in mind in terms of addressing those things. I'm sorry, I'm kind of mixing several things up here, but I think it does come down to that local, acting locally and acting in a way that people have a sense of investment in energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to minimize the challenges that the utilities and others, you know, have had in trying to clean up this mess. With that type of devastation, it really wouldn't make an awful lot of difference probably who the owner really was.
Mm-hmm.
You create that much damage, it's just a huge task to get things up and running again. However, there are some advantages to looking at these issues locally. One of the things that I think some people may have missed was that immediately after the storm, the utilities in the area who were trying to restore power spent quite a bit of focus and time and energy on trying to restore some of the key transmission and substation areas within their system that are the connections to the national electric grid. And while that's certainly a really key and important issue to deal with, it left the folks, you know, out at the ends of the distribution lines in the dark and in many cases still waiting for power to be restored. And if you take a look at the power infrastructure from a local standpoint, and if you institute the sorts of projects that I'm promoting in the book, you're not dealing with long cross-country transmission lines. You're dealing with local distribution of electricity from these distributed generation points to other local parts in the community. So there's not as large a reconstruction project necessary to get local portions of these grids back up and running if you have local sources of electricity and other energy.
And I don't want to get caught in the trap of demonizing big energy companies. And locally,
right.
I actually have family who work for some of them. I think, you know, there's good folks who are trying to do good things at that level. But we have kind of a related question that just came in from David via Facebook, related to big utilities and their role. He says, on the alternative energy front, I hope you bring up the big obstacle of utilities having vastly different rates for what they'll pay, causing it to be a totally different an uneconomical to install in one area while just down the street under a different utility, it'll work. Also the problem, interconnected agreements where utilities can again change the rules at will about allowing renewable energy to hook into the grid. Is that a reality that you're seeing in some places?
Well, absolutely. It's a really good point. Again, we as a nation, we still don't have a coherent national energy policy. And so in the absence of that, most of this has been left to the states and localities to sort these things out for themselves. And, you know, the big utilities and small utilities have their own rules and regulations that they follow. And that varies from state to state, which makes it really hard for anybody who's trying to plan local projects of one sort or another to know for sure, you know, what is going to govern their particular project. And as your listener pointed out, sometimes that the difference depends on who the utility happens to be in that area. Now, there's something known as a feed-in tariff, which is playing an increasingly important role in sort of leveling the playing field and making every utility in a particular area follow the same rules or in a state. Let me just briefly explain what it is. A feed-in tariff is a policy mechanism designed to encourage investment in renewable energy technologies that generate electricity. And a feed-in tariff provides a guaranteed price and access to the grid that gives renewable energy projects the kind of the solid foundation that they need, not only to attract investors, but also to make long-range plans. And the feed-in tariff offers the promise of a model in which almost anyone can become a renewable energy investor and also an owner.
I want to come back to some of the wider themes you're bringing in just a moment, but since we opened sure. with some examples here in Wisconsin, I'm curious, with you being located up in the northeastern part of the country, in Vermont, in a state that for me is kind of was sort of an interesting discover progressive folks doing kind of innovative things, but in a state that's primarily small and medium-sized cities. I wonder if there are things that are happening there that are maybe unique to those opportunities that happen in a smaller community setting.
Well, there are certainly a lot of small local initiatives here in Vermont. I'm not sure that they're necessarily unique to small communities, although in a smaller community, a lot of people tend to know each other. It's probably a little bit easier to work with some of your local officials. But I think these projects can be scaled up or down either way because the technology is scalable. So if you want a small project, you only have a few solar panels, say, for the roof of your house. If you want to do a community project, you can easily scale it up, just add more panels, and so on. So it works for communities of various sizes. But I guess I could give you one example of a small local project that I was involved in here in Vermont. Back in 2010... we decided to try to set up a community solar project, and I'm a member and founding member of a local group called the Acorn Renewable Energy Co-op, and Acorn is an acronym that stands for Addison County Relocalization Network. And it was essentially a peak oil and global warming response group. In the absence of any real progress that was being made at the state level at that time. Anyway, we promoted this project and wanted it to be as community-based as possible. And so we talked to the local town, government town of Middlebury, Vermont, and they suggested a number of potential sites where something like this could be located. And we eventually arrived at about an acre of land that was part of a decommissioned sewage treatment plant. So the land itself was relatively useless for much of anything except that it had a really fantastic southern exposure, solar exposure. And the energy co-op signed a lease with the town for the use of this acre of land for the project. But because the energy co-op was a fairly new organization and didn't have much money, we needed to attract an investor, and we wanted a local investor to help underwrite the cost of the project. And we found that investor in a local insurance company. It also happens to be a co-op. And because 2012 is the International Year of the Cooperative, we suggested to the insurance company that maybe a couple of local co-ops, ourselves and them, could collaborate on this project, and they were quite happy to do so. So at any rate, it took us about 18 months to pull this thing together. The actual construction only lasted for 39 days, which I think puts the entire project into its proper perspective. Most of the time is spent lining things up, getting your financing, getting your permits, getting all the players on board. And then the construction part for this type of project is really pretty straightforward because the technology is there, cost of materials keep falling, and it's a fairly simple type project from an engineering standpoint. And I'd just like to add that the electricity from this community solar project is divided three ways among the three major participants. The town gets a third of the electricity, the energy co-op gets a third of the power, and the insurance company gets a third. And the energy co-op's portion of that is further subdivided into 16 separate subscriber accounts that are, I mean, these people are members of the energy co-op. So it's truly a community-based project. Everyone involved is getting a benefit. So it's really been a win-win-win for everybody involved. And it was the first co-op, municipal co-op project of its type in the state of Vermont. And it actually won a governor's award for environmental excellence this year. So we're really pleased with the way it's turned out.
I could be framing this wrong too, in a sense of small communities, but it sounds like, you know, though resonant with your central theme as you describe this project, or the projects that take off in the sense of cooperatives. And of course, Madison, as I'm sure you know, has gained some distinction in terms of the celebration that's happening this year, because we have disproportionate, a large number of cooperative efforts of various kinds here. But essentially, the central point is, for someone who thinks perhaps their main focus needs to be on influencing national energy policy, which is important, there are things that they can do themselves much closer to home.
Well, absolutely. And again, traditionally we haven't had an awful lot of support from Congress for these sorts of things. And what support there has been tends to come and go depending on which way the political winds are blowing. I think that it's, in many ways, it's just simpler and quicker for local folks to deal with these issues themselves. And I certainly encourage everyone to do whatever they can at the individual level to get their own, households' energy resilience strengthened in whatever ways they can. Get, energy efficiency studies on their home, tighten their homes up. After you've done all of the efficiency and other insulation and other projects that can make your home tighter and more energy efficient, then that's the time to start looking at the possibility of adding some sort of solar technology to your home, like a solar hot water system or a solar electric generating system or whatever it might be. But once you've done that, that's the time, I think, for individuals to start looking to their community to see how else they can help. And there's so much that can be done at the community level that makes an even larger impact on the community and strengthens its resilience to withstand the sorts of problems that we've seen in New York and New Jersey in the past few weeks.
All right. Well, for those of you joining us here at the halfway point of the show, we just want to reset the show. Again, we have Greg Paul online from out in Vermont. He's the author of Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Project. And I believe we do have a caller on the line. Caller, your comment or question, please.
Okay. As a person who's been intimately involved with electrical licensing and power issues in the state of Wisconsin since I was a fairly young guy, I've watched things evolve over time, and I think what your guest is doing is really going in the right direction. The smaller and more decentralized our power is, it's just the word your guest keeps using, it's more resilient. And we really need to get away from the old business models. And while your guest is working with solar, there's a lot of wind projects going on, and we have these huge, huge wind towers. And then even at the corporate farm level, we have smaller wind towers, but they all require the old business model of borrowing a lot of money, you know, being very vulnerable to market conditions if they change, and basically allowing corporate America to own the sun and wind. So the farther we go down the scale of decentralization, and your guest sounds like he's, you know, right at the forefront of that, the better it is.
All right. Thanks, sir, for that comment and affirmation. Greg Paul, your thoughts?
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, he's certainly talking about the right strategies. The current centralized, large-scale energy infrastructure that we have is something that has evolved over time. And I think it's important to remember that back in the earlier days of particularly the electrical industry, that we started out with basically small-scale, local, distributed energy generation, particularly from small hydroelectric facilities all around the country, but especially in New England and Pacific Northwest and elsewhere, where there's a good, you know, water hydro resource. And then after the Depression, a lot of these smaller companies either went bankrupt or were absorbed by larger utilities, who then focused on larger and larger centralized generation projects of one kind or another. So it's evolved from what was essentially a fairly decentralized, small-scale local structure to a very centralized, large-scale structure. And now we need to be, the pendulum needs to swing back again towards the older model, where there was a greater reliance on local distributed power sources of one sort or another. So it's not really a new idea. We're going back to the original idea, which I think in many ways makes a lot more sense as we enter these uncertain times in the years ahead.
Just out of curiosity, was there, if you look at the history here, something socially redeeming, though, about creating entities such as the Tennessee Valley Authority? When you talk about responses to the Depression, that's often used as one of the great success stories. Is there a reason the pendulum had swung the other way, and are there just new realities we need to adjust to now to have it swing in this direction?
Well, I think the realities of the Depression certainly was a reason to look for the larger model. It meant lots of jobs.
Yeah,
needed the work, and it was also part of the, you know, the central government's attempt to, you know, put as many people back to work as quickly as possible with lots of large-scale projects which hadn't really been possible before. But then I think since then we've certainly seen an increasing concentration of control of these resources by a smaller number of large corporate entities. And so there's been a continuation of that process towards centralization all the way through the industry and including the regulatory and approval mechanisms for those types of projects. And that's one of the biggest stumbling blocks for a lot of these new, smaller, local community-type projects who, in many cases, are facing the same sorts of regulatory and approval challenges that would be necessary to build a new Hoover Dam, let's say, for a small local hydroelectric project that in many cases doesn't even involve a dam. And that doesn't make an awful lot of sense, and that's because regulators and bureaucracies tend to react slowly to change, and in many cases they tend to resist change. And they also are charged with having to follow the rules and regulations that, you know, governments have set up for them to administer. And so it's not that they don't like these smaller projects or even necessarily opposed to them. They're simply following the rules and regulations that have evolved over time. And now it's time for many of those rules and regulations to evolve some more so that small local projects aren't faced with these insurmountable barriers.
Is there also a dynamic tension as new technologies are developed with environmental concerns, with you talking about wind energy? If there are large windmills in the middle of Lake Michigan or offshore even, what does that mean? Or Smithsonian Magazine had a picture this month of, power being generated by a huge number of mirrors in the Mojave Desert focused on a water source and superheating that source to produce electricity. And yet in both of those cases, there's potential a loss of migratory birds, other maybe unforeseen environmental effects. How do we weigh those environmental effects with these new technologies?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point, John. And it's a complicated series of issues. And I think it's important for everyone to understand that there's no such thing as a totally benign energy project. No matter what it is, whether it's a coal-fired power plant, nuclear plant, wind farm, whatever, it's going to affect somebody somewhere, probably negatively. And I think that the thing to remember is you have to look at the project as a whole, whatever it might be, and add up all the positives and then add up all the potential problems. And you weigh the pluses and the minuses, and if the positive aspects of the project strongly outweigh the negative impacts, then chances are it makes sense to go forward with the project. But no matter what you're talking about, there's always going to be some sort of negative impact on almost any project like that.
You know, another dynamic tension that comes to mind is I guess, the profit motive that drives so much of what happens in this country. We talk a lot about the larger energy footprint or larger footprint in so many different ways that we have in this country versus similarly set up industrialized countries in Europe, other places in the world.
Right.
Is there a way we can achieve some of these goals and have a smaller footprint? But you know, the problem with that being we're also very concerned about economic growth and other things that seem to be so tied to consuming in a large way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. I think that many Europeans have clearly demonstrated that it's quite possible to live healthy, productive, and happy lives while consuming a lot less energy than we do. We have just, you know, not been very frugal with the use of these energy resources in the past. And the good news is that there's plenty of room for improvement. And that we can cut out enormous amounts of waste without, you know, compromising our lifestyles too seriously. Although I think our current overdependence on fossil fuels, which are very efficient in terms of transforming the fossil fuels into usable energy, although there is still a lot of inefficiency involved, we can cut out a lot of waste at many different levels by making this shift from fossil fuels to renewables, and especially if we are replacing our current large-scale centralized model with much smaller, much more locally based projects that are owned by the community. And ownership is really the key here. That's what transforms what would otherwise just be another corporate energy project into a real engine for local economic development and community energy security. I view this primarily as an economic development issue more than anything else. Mm. And I think that when you focus on that aspect of these types of projects, all of a sudden you get a lot of interest from a lot of people that you wouldn't normally expect to get support for an environmentally positive type project like this. But the key is to look at it in economic terms. It's a huge opportunity for creating jobs and business opportunities at the local level, providing energy security and price stability, which is increasingly important these days. It usually expands the tax base, generates new income, and also gets people directly involved in these projects right from the beginning, so it becomes their project, not somebody else's. And probably more important than anything else is that it retains more money in the local economy, because every energy dollar that you spend on a local project like this stays within the community and recirculates and creates more income and more more money through the so-called multiplier effect. And that's these projects definitely retain more income in the local area and increase the economic benefits substantially over projects that are owned by out-of-area corporate developers who tend to siphon most of the money out of town, out of state, and in many cases even out of country.
All right. Again, for those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Greg Paul. He's the author of Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. We welcome your call, 608-256-2001. You know, as you talk about economic development issues, and we view, I guess, things through the lens of partisan politics in recent years. I think it was the Carter administration that first put solar cells on the roof of the White House. The Reagan administration removed them. There's been a current for, especially, I guess, in the far right, to discount and delegitimize anything connected with the green movement. Do you think that's something that we can turn around, that on a national and local scale, that business will see this in everyone's best interest eventually?
Well, yes, I do believe that. And I certainly have seen that even locally with some of the projects that we've been promoting here in Vermont. As soon as we started viewing these projects as local, you know, economic development issues, all of a sudden there were a bunch of people who wanted to sit down at the table and start to discuss this. And we were talking with people that we never would have dreamed of even having a discussion with. And not only were we having discussions, we were having positive discussions, useful discussions that were bringing people together. So I really do think that this can bridge the political gap, and it can make for very productive discussions at the local level from people who might not otherwise be working together on something like this. So I view it as a very positive opportunity to bring people together at the local level.
In our remaining minutes, I want to focus on some of those local solutions, how they fit together with challenges. But what, before I do that, I guess one of the things I think your book does especially well is really painting the bigger picture, painting why this is such an urgent challenge in our times. In the preface to the book, you have two things that you emphasize, maybe that you could just explain to our listeners. You describe something called the age of extreme energy, and then you also describe this phenomenon called the Hubbert curve, that's sort of a threshold for us ultimately being able to succeed in these efforts. How does all that fit into the bigger picture here?
Sure. Good points, John. Well, the age of extreme energy refers to the fact that our over-reliance, long-term reliance, and now over-reliance on fossil fuels is based on a finite resource. And although, you know, they are continuing to discover new reserves of these various fuels, we have already gotten the easy stuff, and the production of conventional oil peaked back in 2006, and this is something that's widely recognized as having happened. It's not just somebody's imagination. And the fact that shale oil and shale gas and tar sands and all these unconventional sources of fossil fuels have suddenly become so attractive is because much of the conventional supplies are beginning to run out in all over the world. And so the increased price of fossil fuels, especially oil, has made the search for and the production of these unconventional sources of gas and oil, specifically shale oil and shale gas, financially possible because of the high price of oil. And so now the technologies are there to extract this stuff, but it's at a very high price, both financially and also environmentally. Now, I'm sorry, what was the other
point? I think it was you used a term called the Hubbert curve.
Yeah, Hubbert curve. That relates to peak oil. Hubbert was the name of an oil shell oil geologist who back in the, I think it was the 1950s, predicted the peaking of oil production in the United States, and he based it on kind of a bell curve model, which was typical of any individual oil well or even an entire oil field. The production would start to ramp up at the beginning, it would go steeply up, and then as the resource was being depleted, you'd eventually reach a curve kind of at the top, and then you'd come down the other side, and the descent of the production was almost an inverse of the ascent back at the beginning. So it ends up looking like an upside-down U, and the that type of model that shows the rise and fall of production for oil fields is now referred to as Hubbert's curve or Hubbert's peak. And we are bumping along the top of that curve right now and beginning to slide down on the decreased side of oil supplies, especially conventional oil supplies.
Is it sort of analogous to the threshold or the curve that everyone sees, that a lot of scientists see in terms of climate change, that there's a certain point where if we pass over that, it could lead to a disastrous decline in ways that we really can't foresee otherwise?
That's correct, although we're mixing our models here.
Sure.
we're talking more of a hockey stick model with
it's a good one for Wisconsin. Yeah.
And what happens is it goes up, and then all of a sudden it goes way up very fast. And that's the part of the graph we are beginning to approach, and I think we're getting dangerously close to that.
All right. One other thing I wanted to ask about, I guess, is where nuclear power options may figure into this. Mm-hmm. In the light of Fukushima, again, going back to Europe, Germany, some of the other countries have decided to scale back their investment in nuclear power. I think recently there was an announcement that they developed some other alternatives for generating electricity that were 20 times on the scale of nuclear options. And anyway, so there's certainly that example. But is that practical here? Do we need to pull out all the stops? Nuclear options, something we need to consider here in this country, despite the great costs?
Good question, John. I think there's one issue that this really has to come back to, at least for me. After more than 50 years of promises from scientists around the world that they were going to solve the problem with nuclear waste, the problem still hasn't been solved.
Yeah.
And I think that it's just totally irresponsible for anyone to suggest building more nuclear power plants anywhere until this fundamental issue of what to do with the nuclear waste, what to do with it safely, is resolved. At the present time, we've got huge quantities of nuclear waste sitting around in pools and casks, mainly at electrical generating facilities. And there have been really no adequate long-term plans for what to do with this stuff. And if you can imagine a scenario in the future where we have more and more dangerous storms disrupting, the national infrastructure and creating, enormous and expensive problems for repairing infrastructure, What's going to happen to all that nuclear waste that's just sitting around that still hasn't been properly disposed of? So I just don't see how we can responsibly move ahead with any more nuclear power plant construction at the present time.
I think you get a lot of affirmations from folks here in Madison that are very concerned about that issue.
Yeah.
Well, hey, the other thing, I mean, I wanted to move this back to solutions, but I think another great frame in your book is resonant with this notion that solutions have to be applied locally, is that different solutions work best in different parts of the country. So perhaps a biofuel type solutions make sense up here in the upper Midwest, but solar energy makes more sense in the Southwest.
Yes, John, that's a really good point. Every community, every area is going to have slightly different resources that they can look at as potentially being part of a local community energy project. And as you say, it's going to be different in different regions. New England, Pacific Northwest, probably portions of the upper Midwest certainly have forest resources that they can rely on for some sort of biomass initiatives. Southwest certainly has an abundance of solar energy. There's plenty of good wind resources, particularly in the upper Midwest, but also offshore. And I think it's just, it's important that people understand that they have to go through an initial sort of screening process to decide what local resources that they have that are available to them would make the most sense for a project for their community, but also to look at that resource and understand that the different technologies that harvest those or use those resources have different regulatory and approval processes that you have to go through. And some things are fairly straightforward and simple, like community solar, and others can be much more complicated and expensive, like a large-scale hydroelectric project, which can take years and years to wade through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approval process, although there have been some recent improvements in that area. So it's going to be a little different for every community, and they just need to figure out what makes the most sense for their particular project in their particular area using the resources that they have available. But I would say that almost every community in the country has got the possibility for at least one or two of these types of projects, but
all
they're
right.
going to be different.
As usually happens with a compelling subject like this, time has flown by, and we're down to just our last several minutes here. But, the greater body of your work, in addition to this book, and you do touch on these issues in this book as well, though, also deals with kind of very close to home, the things that people can do, for example, within their own homes.
Yep.
Just one thing that stood out that I didn't have a chance to look into more detail, but you described, I think, a type of heat pump that can produce a 400% increase in efficiency in someone's home. Can you just touch on some of the options, ways that people can make a difference in their own homes?
Well, so I'd say first and foremost, which I mentioned previously, was to get an energy audit for their home and make sure that it's as energy efficient as possible. It might involve, insulation or taping up heat ducts that are leaking air. Could be any number of different things like that that maybe aren't very sexy as, like a solar-mounted photovoltaic system would be. And you really can't see what's what you've done tightening up the basement. But the return on investment for those energy efficiency projects may be far higher than from something like fancy new windows or even a PV system for your roof. So energy efficiency first, and then you want to look at the possibilities that you might have for solar or wind or whatever it might be. That just doesn't make sense to put an expensive renewable energy project like a solar electric on your roof if your house is inefficient. You're just wasting money all the way around.
I apologize if I interrupt, but just the last thought, I wanted to kind of come full circle into where we began in terms of looking at this as while something we have to deal with locally, also the national scale of all of this. What would you have to say to folks that want to make a difference, they want to make a visit to their congressperson or senator and bring home the point that it's something that we need to embark on a national scale?
Well, certainly. Anything that we can do at the national level to encourage these types of projects is worthwhile and certainly worth the effort. So anything at all that they can say to their legislative representatives to encourage and increase these types of projects and increase funding for them especially, and especially long-term funding. That's something that any business, regardless of what it is, needs to know before they can really write a business plan.
Well, one of your part is it possible to reframe this not just as an issue of dire consequence, dire need, but something that would ultimately help build this country and build communities all across the country?
Absolutely. This is all about jobs.
Yep.
And income. There's, you know, enormous opportunities here. There's, I probably don't have time to go into it, but there are even some cities that have taken on some of these initiatives. Gainesville, Florida is one in particular, where they've made a real difference with supporting renewables.
All right. No, hey, Greg, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a very illuminating conversation. Perhaps we can have you on again and maybe get some local activists to interact with. But, again, this is a fascinating book called Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects, a Community Resilience Guide. Again, Greg Paul has been joining us in conversation from out in Vermont. And once again, thank you so much for being on A Public Affair.
You're most welcome, John. Thank you.
Thank you. This is John Quinlan. Have a great week. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded with information that will never be recorded.